Thanks for tuning in. I'm Dr. Antonio Oftoli, and this is the Chief Growth Officer Podcast. This podcast is for current and aspiring leaders who are disrupting the status quo and transforming the world. The podcast not only looks at breakthrough ideas and innovations, but also gets in the trenches with real-life leaders to show how they think about and move forward innovation and change. And importantly, the Chief Growth Officer Podcast helps leaders like you grow the organizational and personal capacity to create a better future. On this episode, we'll look at what it takes to foster a mindset of transformation and the capacity for breakthrough innovation in a large organization. We'll do this by talking with Don Allen, Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer for Stanley Black & Decker. Stanley Black & Decker, isn't that a firm that makes tools? I can imagine you thinking, and what could they possibly know about innovation? It turns out they know a lot, and they've honed their innovation craft over a long time. In 1843, more than 150 years before our conversation with Don Allen, Frederick Stanley opened the Stanley Bolt Factory, a small shop in New Britain, Connecticut, that produced bolts, hinges, bits, and other tools. In the ensuing decades, the company blossomed, expanding its product base and geographic footprint. And by the turn of the 21st century, the firm, which specialized in hand tools for the construction industry, had blossomed into a multinational corporation with approximately $2.7 billion in annual revenue. This ability to innovate and grow year over year is what has enabled Stanley Black & Decker to grow by $9 billion just over the past 16 years. What drives this phenomenal and consistent growth? The capacity to innovate and an activist mentality that energizes the organization when Don Allen says, let's disrupt ourselves before somebody does it to us. We can learn a lot from Don Allen on what it takes to foster this activist mentality and consistently innovate and transform. Let's dig in. Well, thanks again, Don. So one thing I would love to talk with you about is many leaders, of course, have a hard time taking a long established organization. And Stanley Black & Decker has been around for more than 100 years. Getting to new innovations, to bold breakthrough innovation and transformation, but also thinking about how do you manage that transformation and the risk at the same time. So you've created an excellent example at SBD, at Stanley Black & Decker, at creating this type of runway for major transformation. How do you do that? How do you balance this optimizing, you know, current value with all the product lines you have and making sure that you're hitting your goals, but also try and create this new value?
Yeah, I think the way that I think about it is, you know, transformation has become so prevalent across all aspects of business or life, I guess, in general. The transformation of kind of innovation of products and, you know, doing breakthrough things. You know, you listened to me talk about breakthrough innovation a few years ago, and we've kind of evolved that now to extreme innovation, just to refresh it a little bit as far as the terminology, but the concept is still the same. You know, dedicating resources that are kind of in that, you know, offsite, low-cost world, where it's almost like a startup feel to it, is something that's been very successful for us. We have those pods now in every major business, at least in one, if not multiple locations, to continue to do that. But the thing that's really changed a lot for us in the last 2 or 3 years is how aggressive we've gotten of building out an innovation ecosystem, which is really, for so many decades, companies that just work internally, they'd hire engineers and other technicians and specialists, and they would be the ones that would be creating whatever the next innovation of a product was, in our case, tools or security systems, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't work in today's world on its alone, given the pace of change. And so, you know, we've built out this ecosystem the last 2 years, maybe three, which is we still have all our internal resources. We have people working on breakthrough or extreme innovation projects. But we also have these startup organizations that we've made venture investments in, where we might have put 10, 15% ownership stake into them. We have a position on the board and they're working on something specific that we see as a potential innovation for us, you know, down the road that might impact our business in a positive way or adjust our, and it could radically change our business in the future. But we're actually part of that process versus, you know, having something kind of come at us unexpectedly. And then the third thing is really working with some other major companies that aren't necessarily in our industry, but maybe have similar goals. And a good example of that would be with Lego. You know, they and we have been looking at additive manufacturing and really, you know, how do you through 3D printers and other technologies, begin to start producing some of your products for the future. In our case, it would be hand tools or components of tools that are used to put together a power tool. In their case, obviously, it's the Lego blocks.
Yeah.
There's no competition there. So we're partnering together with a joint venture startup, and we're kind of running that organization with the startup to figure out, can we evolve this technology to serve their industry and serve our industry? And just building that ecosystem out allows us the flexibility to move faster and not have to be the one that's always making all the investments financially and human resource perspective.
Uh-huh.
And you actually can move quicker and adjust quicker when you say, okay, that didn't work, now we're going to go over here. Versus if you build a team of 100 people, that's tough to flex. And
yeah.
And so you got to kind of have a little bit of both. And that's been a big part of what we've done on the product innovation side for the last probably almost 3 years now, I guess.
That's brilliant, Don. To help people learn a bit more about what you're doing with this, so I think in the past you've described your innovation in the context of core innovations that you invest in,
right,
which involve making incremental improvements to existing products. And you've had this breakthrough innovation, or maybe what you're calling extreme innovation now. And you're saying that the ecosystem concept really helps you to move forward, perhaps both of those. What's your definition of an ecosystem? How do you define that?
It's basically a set of partners and internal resources that are specifically working on innovation for Stanley Black & Decker. It's just different what they're doing. And the ecosystem goes broad beyond products too, because now what we're doing is we're working with other companies like Rockwell Automation, Microsoft, a company called Sonic in the Midwest that makes robotic machines. And we're working with them to redesign our supply chain and manufacturing footprint so it's more automated and more digitized going forward to drive innovation in that space, which makes us much more efficient in our manufacturing, but also improves the quality. It's all those people together that build this ecosystem for us that not only covers things on the product side, but it covers things on the manufacturing supply chain side. And then the third area it covers is really back office, because we're finding that there's a lot of companies out there like Accenture, HCL, Infosys, et cetera, that are very specialized with technology on doing finance transactional work, IT transactional work, and HR transactional work. And so partnering with them to figure out, well, what do we use our full-time resources for versus use them for? And people label that as outsourcing, but it's not really outsourcing anymore. Mm-hmm. What it is they rebadge some of our employees. So we have employees like in a shared service center in Warsaw, Poland, that they're rebadging, they're taking over running that operation, they're maintaining the benefits of those employees, and they're going to be working on our accounts and records, but they have higher levels of automation. They know how to run this more efficiently than we do. And so it's not really outsourcing. What it is giving them responsibility to run something in a much more efficient, effective way that allows us on the functional side to maybe focus on some things that create more value versus some of those transactional things that need to happen. And,
right,
and the good news is employees don't tend to get displaced through that process. They change companies, but they're actually better off in an Accenture or HCL because they have the ability now to work on not only Stanley Black & Decker, but as their career progresses, they might end up working on some of the other clients of those firms. This is really the ecosystem. All these things across all these different spectrums is that ecosystem.
And it runs so counter, I guess, to how society and industry has been organized for the past couple hundred years, right? Around hierarchy, around silos, around strong top-down type mechanisms to move people and products and services. Has there been some type of a cultural shift that's had to take place there in order to create these ecosystems and to get people comfortable with working across boundaries, across firm boundaries and organizational boundaries and maybe even sector boundaries in some cases?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, it's an ongoing cultural transition that we're far from where we want to be, but we've made a lot of progress. But what happens is when people get exposure to this, it helps them respond to the agility and the flexibility that people need today, because these kind of standard frameworks that we've been in business for decades now, hundreds of years, they're too rigid to move as the world moves. And what it does is the employees start to realize, well, hey, I could get, instead of my team of 20 doing the things that we do, if I could get four of these people go over and they're working for Accenture and they're working on that, it frees me up for the other 16 people, and maybe I add a couple along the way to work on more value opportunities in the company that, you know, free us up for that kind of agility and flexibility. And so as they get exposure to it, they really love it. But it's just that transition of not really knowing what it's going to be like until they get to that next state is where people are, you know, it's just a natural fear. You know, you could take it as basic as a person on the plant floor who's manufacturing a product for us. And then we come in and say, hey, we're going to bring in all these robots. We're going to digitize the plant. Hey, but at the same time, what we're going to do is we're going to retrain you, reskill you, and educate you. So your job is your job changes to something that probably is a higher skill set. You know, you're prepared to do that. And we have a pretty good success rate of doing that. We're about 80 to 85% of those people actually do reskill and reskill up. It's similar on the back office side, a finance person or an IT person, where they're used to a transactional activity. If you reskill them or you rebadge them, they actually go through a kind of upskilling process in both cases, which you have to do because that's the challenge of society that I think we all of us recognize technology is moving so quick that we need to have the ability to reskill and retrain these folks as we're going, because there won't be enough people to do the work if you don't do that.
Yeah. And you said that most successfully move through that, but I wonder how that impacts, say, the identity of people in the organization. So an organizational psychologist would talk a lot about people attach some of their value in life to what they do, what they work on. That becomes part of their identity. It's kind of like this, what we do, how we do it, and who we are thing. But if you're changing what they do, you're changing how they do it, you know, what type of work they do, it inevitably then changes their perception of who they are, their identity. Is it such that we're like the brand of Stanley Black & Decker and the values you instill and the vision and purpose tend to override that change? And so they maybe more buy into this type of change? How do you kind of manage that identity piece?
Well, I think the identity changes in a positive way, I guess, is the way that I kind of see this play out, or it has played out. It's like, okay, so if I'm doing a job today and I identify myself as an accountant, and so I have to do accounting things and that's my job, and I'm proud that I'm an accountant. Well, your job changes where you're still doing accounting. You're just not doing detailed debits and credits and logging and journal entries and things like that. Mm-hmm. But instead you're looking at, you know, more higher level accounting transactions and saying, how should this be accounted for? Doing the research on the accounting side. And so your job actually evolves to something that's, in theory, still something you're very proud of, but you're not doing some of the other activities that might be rogue or mundane, and it allows you to actually stimulate and use your brain. Now, there's always some people that struggle with that change because they would rather just do the mundane things. But we do our best to reskill and retrain people. And so far, the effect of that for people that we can't reskill is about 15%. And, you know, we're doing our best to minimize that. But I just don't think companies can survive if they continue to do things the way they're always doing them.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
So that's interesting, this idea that companies won't survive if they can't do that. Because I think we're seeing that everywhere. The other CFOs and CEOs I talk to, they're saying, you know, this rapid change in the world, the risk, the need to drive innovation. It's a, you know, it's a do or die type world right now, but it still requires you as a leader of the organization to move people to act. I guess the framing or a narrative that you use as one of the key leaders within Stanley Black & Decker to get people to buy into change, to want change and to move forward?
Yeah, I guess the way that I talk about it is probably similar to what you've heard from me for the last 20 minutes or so, which is I talk about it in the positive aspects of this change, but then I'm empathetic to, you know, how difficult it's going to be and the reskilling that needs to happen. And, you know, we want to be part of helping you be successful through that transition. And, you know, I think most people respond positively to that, saying, okay, they're going to give me the tools and the training and the lifelong learning aspects of this so that I continue to develop as a person and as a professional. And that's the way I talk to it. And I don't use it as I don't use the threat of the world moving so fast. If we don't move, you know, the whole company is going to collapse.
Yeah.
I think that there's a way to describe it that, hey, we have to do this because the world is moving so fast, but you got to focus more on the positive aspects of doing this and why, how we'll all be better off as individuals and as a company once we work through this transformation, which maybe the transformation never ends. Maybe it's just an ongoing forever transformation of all of us. But, and you know, I think the general, I always say this, that every person deep down doesn't really want to change. Mm-hmm. And so the first reaction, you know, I'll even look at myself, you know, I can think of a lot of things that I would not prefer not to change. But, you know, when you step back and you think about how the world is changing and what's changing around us, you know, if you really want to be a productive part of society in some way, shape, or form, you have to change too. And it doesn't mean you have to become someone who's 180% different than you were before, but, you know, you do need to modify yourself and you need to be a disciple of really a lifelong learning. And how do you continue to learn and evolve? And there'll always be people that won't want to do that. But in our case, I think we're finding the vast majority do want to do it.
And probably they see that, you know, the great line of success you guys have had in building that type of forward-leaning innovation and transformation, and that probably helps quite a bit. And you guys have been doing this for a while now. So one of the things you just said, I think, was illustrative of where the world is you said that this might not be a one-time transformation or a series of innovations, but it's almost a constant. You know, so one thing I worry about is, you know, how do we keep people engaged in that constantly without getting innovation fatigue or transformation fatigue? And maybe this ecosystem concept is a great way to do that, right? If you can distribute some of this transformation and innovation across a set of organizations and people, that will help you become faster, more agile, and continually be looking around corners to figure out what's next. Do you think that helps?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things I tell people as part of this is that we can't do this alone. We need this ecosystem to help us do this. And, you know, because if we try to do it alone, we won't be able to do it. We need all these different companies working together and partners with our employee base to make this successful. And you're right. We have been working on this for 5, 7, 8 years at least. And I think what we're finding now is people are getting used to this. Okay, this is kind of the way it is. The world just keeps transforming. We need to keep transforming. And so we're all tweaking ourselves and adjusting ourselves as each year is going by over time. And I think, you know, as you spend 5, 6, 7 years doing this, it becomes kind of the norm. It's what you're used to. And it's what you expect on a go-forward basis.
Yeah, you're kind of building a muscle for this type of transformation continuously. Yeah. It's a marathon. So, but how does this take place? So for you on the other side of your office or the other side of your desk, whatever you want to say, when you have analysts coming in from Wall Street, and of course you're working across the C-suite within the firm, and we're looking at quarterly results here, and finance often has a way of stifling innovation because oftentimes, you know, we'll look at measures that are relatively short term and IRR and just different NPV ways of measuring value. But it must be hard to look at this ecosystem work and have your finance team put valuations on the portfolio of work taking place there. I mean, how do you as a CFO maybe educate other CFOs and how that actually works in the real world to project out value in the future like that and be able to report inwards and to Wall Street about what you're doing? And thinking about this idea of ecosystems and this innovation portfolio you have embedded within this ecosystem, and so much of your valuation now is going to be, you know, tied to what you generate from these ecosystems. So how do you, on the other side of your desk there in dealing within the C-suite at Stanley Black & Decker with analysts on Wall Street, for example, talk to them about measuring this type of innovation? Because I imagine, you know, finance, of course, has a way of stifling innovation sometimes through, you know, certain measures of near-term value. Yeah. And so how do you kind of balance that long-term growth via ecosystems with the short-term need to meet quarterly demands?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something that, you know, I personally, along with a lot of other folks in the finance leadership team, put a lot of effort into, because there is a force within the company, for lack of a better word, that really, when times get tough, and we'll use last year, we only had Chinese U.S. tariffs, we had commodity inflation, we had currency pressures that were all impacting our P&L, and we had to do different things to manage our costs to get through that. And the force or the desire by so many people in the organization to want to cut things that were investments for the medium term and the long term. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we'd be better off cutting that versus cutting resources or costs that are related to, you know, generating opportunities here in the next 6 months. And my view is no, that's not true. I mean, there may be a time where you do that, but it would really have to be the whole world turning down and we're in like a major crisis and we're trying to survive. We're far from in survival mode right now. You know, yeah, we have pressures and, you know, things like that, but we're still finding ways to grow our top line and grow our earnings. And that's not an environment that you should be cutting long-term investments and structure. And therefore, we need to strike the right balance. And if people like myself and senior leaders in finance don't play that role, nobody will. And so because they, in our company in particular, the leaders and the CEO look at us and say, okay, we'll solve this problem, finance. Tell us how, you know, we overcome these headwinds. What are we going to do? And it would be easy to come and say, okay, let's cut these $300 million in investments we have that are related to, they don't generate any value in the next 12 to 18 months. But you know what happens when you do that. You know, you'll be fine for the next 12 to 18 months. Then you got a big hole.
Right.
You got a problem. And you just have to put that in your culture and you have to put it in your mentality. And I obviously have a CEO that's clearly very supportive of that and how we run finance. And is frankly very appreciative of the fact that we maintain that balance through times like this. It's important. If you don't do that, you will end up cutting those areas.
And imagine there are certain innovations that you can do both with, meaning that for example, maybe with some AI stuff you're doing with some of the RSA in robotics, where you're saying we can drive innovation within the firm now to reduce costs, but also it's going to help us become more productive. It's going to help our product cycles move faster. Maybe our supply chain is going to be more agile. It might even lead to being able to create new products faster by looking at analytics in new ways in order to see where trends are going with consumer sentiment and what consumers are looking for tools and security, et cetera. Do you have examples of some of this emerging innovation on AI robotics that help you do both of those?
Absolutely. So the best example I can give you is about 2 years ago, I created a center of excellence for Industry 4.0. And their focus has been on automation through robotics and advanced data analytics and digitizing the plant system, machine learning, artificial intelligence. And we have about 50 people in that center of excellence. It's just actually based in Hartford, Connecticut. And it costs about $20 million a year. It's not cheap. And so people in the other parts of our company, they don't do it anymore, but initially they're saying, why are we spending money on that? You know, that's not creating value. What you have to do is show them, no, you're wrong. This does create value. So last year, the value they created in our supply chain paid for their annual cost of $20 million.
Wow.
This year in 2020, they're going to create $50 million of value, which is well in excess of their annual cost. And then we expect that to be the case for the next 5 to 7 years, $50 to $60 million on an annual basis. And so you have to help people understand, no, you're wrong. This innovation, although it might not generate a net positive, or even it might even be a net negative in year one, but over the 3 to 4 time horizon, it ultimately will create value that we wouldn't get if we didn't have that in place. And there's probably, you could do the same thing with RPA. Mm-hmm. We have about 20 people dedicated to, you know, cobots and automation of transactional things. And they cost us, I think, $2 to $3 million a year or something like that. And right now, on an annual basis, they're generating $10 to $15 million of positive productivity in the financial performance.
So,
in both cases, these things lost money in the first year, but now they make money for us.
That's fascinating, Don. Without divulging any industry secrets, can you unpack that a little bit for me? So, say when you're looking at RSA or maybe the supply chain example, I imagine a lot of that, the innovation taking place there, it's taking costs out of the system, right? So you're doing things to optimize the supply chain to make it faster and cheaper, et cetera.
Yeah.
Is it also leading to getting to market better or are new ways, or actually like opening up new ideas for products and services?
Yeah, I mean, it's both. I mean, I think right now where it's really heavily, there is a productivity aspect. One of the challenges that we have as a manufacturer, in particular in the United States and Europe, is there's not enough, we can't find enough employees. So if we don't drive this type of productivity through automation and digitization and reskill our existing workforce, we wouldn't be able to go where we're trying to go from a growth perspective, because there just aren't enough workers out there. I mean, as much as the current administration says, I want to bring more manufacturing back to the U.S., and that's all interesting, but there's not enough people to do that work.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to think through, okay, if we're going to keep bringing back manufacturing to the U.S., because we've been doing that for about 7 years now, we have to do the manufacturing in a way that is requires less people versus the way we would have done it 20 years ago. And the technologies are out there. And so you have that ability. Then you also have, as you automate these things and you digitize them, the quality of the product goes up, meaning the consistency of the quality. So, you know, maybe before your warranty costs of, you know, 2% of your products have to come back because of some type of quality failure. You know, now that number is like below 1% as we get some of these technologies in place. And that's just going to continue to get better. So there's a big benefit from that perspective as well. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, so if, you know, for people learning from what you're saying, most of them are sitting and probably thinking, you know, Don spends 90% of his time on thinking about the future and creating new value and, you know, leaning into looking around corners to see what's next. Where do you really spend your time? So historically, most CFOs probably spent 75% of their time on retroactive analysis and reporting and making sure the numbers were tight. Now with automation and whatnot, you can free up more of your time. The machines can do that. Are you spending your, you know, 50-50 of your time on looking backwards and half looking forward, or what's the ratio?
For me, I probably spend 10% of my time looking backwards. I mean, I really am more focused on overseeing all the transformational efforts in our company, all the things that we've been talking about for the last several minutes. Mm-hmm. I'm also a significant partner to many of our business presidents and their leadership teams to help them execute their strategy or adjust their strategy going forward, or apply some of these transformational efforts into their business in a more effective manner. That's where I spend all my time. I mean, I joke sometimes with some of my peers because they talk about how much time they spend in finance, and I said, I would be miserable if that was my life. I don't want to do that.
There's only so much time you want to spend closing the books, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I do have the added benefit of having a great finance leadership team. So, mm-hmm. you know, they can do all those things. They can bring it to me and tell me, you know, what happened, what the number, a lot of the numbers are what they are. And then we can talk about what we do, if we have to do anything in response to that. But, you know, I think the role of CFO has to move away from that. And it has to be, I've said this to other people, the CFO is the perfect person to be the chief transformation officer of the company, because they have all the abilities to do it from the perspective of, they see everything in the company. They see where all the levers are, where all the challenges are. They have a sense of the industry and what's happening in the industry. And they can build the partnerships with senior leaders in other companies and some of the consulting firms. And but you have to have a desire to do it in that role. But if you have the right person in the role who really likes to do it and enjoys it, it really should be more of a chief transformation officer versus a chief financial officer.
Fascinating. And you've been doing that for a while now. I did want to circle back a bit to this, the special forces teams that you guys are using there. So I imagine that fits a bit within your ecosystem strategy, where you're saying in some ways we're collaborating across boundaries with other firms to, you know, get to market, create new products and services. You have startup organizations that you're investing in, but you also have this internal capacity to develop breakthrough innovation or extreme innovation. So historically, you've had this. I guess what we call special forces or teams set up to look at the future and see what Stanley Black & Decker can do to create new products and services to meet that future demand. How is that going? Can you describe that concept and what it's been up to lately?
Yeah, it's going great. I mean, we have you know, in our tools business, we've probably come out with, let's see, six breakthrough innovations in the power tool side of our business. And they've generated, at this point, on an annual basis, they're probably generating almost $700 to $800 million of annual value for revenue. And so it's gone incredibly well, and it's really helped us become even more of an industry leader around innovation in power tools across the globe. And so that has worked fantastically for that particular business. For the other businesses, it moves a little slower because they tend to be, you know, longer cycle businesses. And so, like, we have an engineered fastening business that, you know, serves the automotive manufacturing industry. And, you know, that industry moves at a slower pace because it's really based on the next new model and the next new design that comes out. But we've come up with new ways to do fastening through our breakthrough innovation team that doesn't require, you know, certain types of steel rivets anymore. It uses other technologies like adhesive as an example. And that's kind of game changing in that particular space because it's a much more efficient process than using riveting machines and applying those rivets as you put the car together. And then in the our security business, we've done the same thing where we have a bunch of ventures around drone technology and certain school security technology that will be able to pick up the sound of a gunshot and immediately be able to identify where that gunshot was in the school. And it can automatically lock the school down in a certain way based on the placing of the gunshot, which is a horrible thing to think that we have to do. But, you know, in today's world, having something that really minimizes the impact of a gunman. And then the next step is what technology to have that even prevents a gunman from getting into the school and through the different. And obviously that's more complicated because it requires town councils and all these other things to approve those types of changes. But the other one, the first one I mentioned, is an area that you don't necessarily need that approval from the town council, where it's just, hey, this is a reactive thing that we're going to do to protect as many children and teachers as possible. And that's kind of a breakthrough technology that we've come up with in the last 6 months in that area. So it's got a lot of momentum, and it's an area that it's actually an area that our CEO has become incredibly passionate about the last 3 or 4 years because he's seen the value that comes out of it. And so that's kind of, he's adopted that as one of his big mantra items of don't ever touch those investments, you know, make sure that we continue to invest in the space. And you know, obviously I'm aligned with that because that was part of creating it a long while back.
What's the team structure like for Special Forces? Is it engineers, but do you put finance people in there as well and marketing people, or what type of structure do you use to generate the best ideas?
It's usually about 8 to 10 people in total. As I said earlier, they're kind of off in some remote warehouse or office location away from the core business. They're kind of operating like they're a startup. There's like a venture board that for each business, the senior leader, like the business president, the CFO, and a few other folks, that they have to come and present to that venture board as to how they're progressing on the different projects they're working on, and also present any new ideas that they have related to certain areas that maybe, you know, we're not pursuing right now. And so it's kind of run like a, you know, a venture capital type of investment almost, and treated that way. And there's usually one finance person and one HR person kind of in that mix as well, but mostly engineers.
And what are kind of the broad strokes on the rate of, you know, failure versus success, to use those crass terms in looking at these teams?
About for every 100 things that we work on, probably 8 to 10 are successful. So there's a lot of things we work on that just aren't successful, or the technology is not evolved enough for us to create what we're trying to create. And so we shelve a lot of that stuff and just see how markets and things evolve over time. And so we've actually picked some things off the shelf that have been on the shelf for maybe 3 years because there's been some technological change around batteries that now allow us to do what we're trying to do 3 years ago. But the failure rate's high. But I think, you know, our mantra is, you know, fail quickly. Don't expect to be successful with every single project. You know, go through the process, but, you know, if it's not going to work for technical reasons or other reasons, then just put it on the shelf and get working on the next thing, because if you get bogged down, that's where you end up wasting a lot of time and energy.
Yeah. So the communication really has to, the communication, I suppose, and trust within these teams, along with the venture board, has to be pretty high level and pretty tight. So it sounds like in many ways you've created this environment that Amy Edmondson of Harvard Business School calls psychological safety. Essentially, companies with this trusting workplace perform better. You can give candid feedback, you know, openly admit mistakes, yeah. learn from each other more. Is that something you've intentionally fostered, I guess, in a way, or is it something that organically developed?
Well, we intentionally did foster that because we were a company where failure was never an option. So, you know, for decades, and you know, my first 10 years with the company, you never wanted to fail. You never wanted to be somebody that had to go explain why you failed. The last 10 years, though, you know, we actually encourage people to take risks, but, you know, not risk in the sense of being haphazard and crazy, but, you know, if you feel like there's an opportunity to be successful with a new product innovation or a new idea, whatever it might be, let's take a risk. But it's not going to work out, fail quickly and move on. Mm-hmm. And it took the leadership team had to be supportive of that. It had to, you know, because the leadership team before, which included me, was, no, we don't want any mistakes. I want to, you know, no failures, no mistakes. Now, the last 10 years, it's like, no, we accept that. I'm glad you gave that a try. Outstanding. And, you know, we don't want to fail 100 out of 100, but the likelihood of that is probably pretty low.
Don, how did you kind of like personally / professionally make that shift, right? Since you were part of the team originally that was, you know, hey, no failure around here. You must have had to, you know, grapple with that internally a little bit within your own mind and heart. What helped you to change your, I guess, your mindset about that?
Well, I think, you know, maybe I had to fake it my first year or two because I wasn't sure it was the right thing to do. I had to be a bit of an actor and really, you know, say the right thing in the setting and say, oh, I'm so glad you tried that. That's outstanding. You know, let's go on to the next thing and try something else and see how that goes. And I'd probably walk away and go in my office and bang my head against the wall saying, oh my goodness. You know? But over time, you see that actually works pretty well because the teams think broader now. The people think broader. They don't think in the controlled fashion of, all right, well, I want to make sure that whatever I do the thing that I know I'm going to be successful and there's no way I can get in trouble. You know, now they think more of like, oh, well, what's the spectrum of possibility? What's the art of the possible? And, you know, what's the level of risk and the scale of these things? And are some of them just way too high risk because they put the company at risk, or just a level of risk that, okay, the worst case is we spent a couple $100,000 and it didn't work out, and really figuring out how to balance that. And you, someone like me who's changed, our CEO's changed, and many of our business presidents have changed as well. And I think as people see that behavior, they realize, okay, these guys actually mean what they say. They're not just saying it. And it's really the only way to change the culture, but you have to kind of force yourself to do it because it's not naturally comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Have there been examples where various teams within Special Forces have either dropped something, but then 2-3 years later, it's come back and was reinvigorated because something, you know, environmentally changed, or an example where maybe different teams combined and their individual breakthrough innovations they were working on came together to create something new?
Yeah, I mean, there is an example. It's not public, so I can't really give you a lot of detail, but there's an example on the power tool side where throughout motor technology and motor design in a power tool, that we were trying to do something about 4 years ago, I think maybe. Mm-hmm. And the material and the technology was not working to make it successful at that point because the size of the engine was just too big for it to work the way we wanted to. So we wanted it to be a smaller engine. Now with a few changes around certain materials and some electronic design within the tool that didn't exist before, yeah, we've actually come up with something new that when they create a tool that's even more powerful and has longer runtime and a smaller size than anything we've seen in the market before that. So that's an example of maybe something that flopped 4 years ago because of the reasons I mentioned. And now we'll be bringing some to market in the next year and a half.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting dynamic because sometimes these teams like Special Forces can come up with something that's just too ahead of its time, or other environmental right. conditions aren't ripe enough. And so oftentimes it's not a lost investment. Well, initially it looks like and feels like it, but 2 or 3 years later it can come back and really propel some new service forward. So it's pretty fascinating. Don, if you're kind of take a look back, you've been CFO and part of the C-suite there at Stanley Black & Decker for the past, 20 years, but really CFO for a little bit more than 10. And you scan forward a bit. What's the most important lesson or two or three lessons that you would want emerging CFOs, aspiring CFOs, and to learn from you? What should they take and build into their capabilities and set of thinking?
I would say one, don't fall into the trap of being a traditional CFO. There's skill sets related to a traditional CFO that are very important around controllership and process and making sure the numbers are right. At the foundation, you need to make sure you and your organization never lose sight of that important aspect, but that should be a small part of what you do. Ultimately, you really should be gravitating towards somebody that can be either act as a chief operating officer, act as a chief transformation officer, because that is ultimately how you're going to have the biggest impact on your company in the short term, midterm, and the long term. Mm-hmm. And I preach this to everybody I saw, whether you're a CFO or whatever you want to be. You should be thinking, okay, your discipline says I need to do this. If you spend 80% of your time on your discipline, you're probably not adding as much value as you could to your company. And so whatever the metric is for you, mine's 10%, the discipline of finance. But if it's yours is 30 or 40, that's great, but you got to make sure you're spending that other, percentage on all these other things that create a lot of value, whether it's transformational, whether it's helping fix broken businesses or whatever it might be. See that as your role. Don't see yourself as a traditional finance person. And the second thing I tell people is don't be closed-minded. You got to be open-minded to everything in today's world. You have to listen to people's opinions. You have to listen to new ideas. You have to build out an ecosystem of thought leaders that help you recognize what's happening out there. And you have to find time to do that, because that ultimately will create a lot of value for your company as well. And then the third thing I would say is just, be an inspirational leader to people. Help them get energized and excited about whatever the mission and the journey of your company is, and help them be energized and excited about what they're doing and make them better people. I think if you do those three things, you can be an outstanding CFO.
Well, that's brilliant, Don. Thank you so much for those insights. That's our podcast for today. Thanks for tuning in. If you're interested in learning more about the Chief Growth Officer Initiative or transformational leadership in general, please visit us at lnwprogram.org. I'm Antonio Oftley.